This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello and welcome to The Bunker. I'm Ros Taylor. One of the ironies of the pandemic is that while most political debate was effectively suspended, decisions were being taken by politicians, doctors and ordinary people that had huge philosophical implications. From the way things were debated, you'd sometimes think it was just pro-lockdown versus anti-lockdown in some sort of libertarian-communitarian face-off. But it's far more difficult than that. Who should get all the treatment available and who should be allowed to die? Should you publicly shame someone for breaking lockdown rules? Did we privilege the nuclear family and treat people who live alone in a particularly unjust way? These are questions we'd struggle with at any time, but in the context of a pandemic, they had to be made quickly, and some, inevitably, were made badly. Now we have the chance to reflect a bit more on them, and with me to do that and talk about some of the challenges that he sees coming round the corner is Avik Bhattacharya, the co-editor of Political Philosophy in a Pandemic with Faye Nyker, and also the chief economist at the Social Market Foundation think tank. Welcome to The Bunker, Avik.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with something that everyone had a stake in during the pandemic. During the lockdowns, we very quickly saw the emergence of public shaming of people who were breaching laws or even breaching just guidelines, because often it was not at all clear what was a law and what was a guideline. And they were called COVIDiots on social media, and sometimes their pictures were published. Everyone from people who were walking in the Peak District as a family and therefore not really spreading anything much at all, to Dominic Cummings and all that that meant. Fueled by social media, really, this phenomenon was not going to be possible before social media came along. Is that kind of shaming ever a good idea? Because one of the most interesting parts of this book is where your authors take apart the uses that shaming can have.
Yeah, and it's a great contribution, because I think it starts from the recognizing the kind of appeal of shaming and saying that these rules or norms that we want to enforce are very important. And if people are breaching them, that makes us angry. That makes us want to reinforce them. And you can see how calling people out in that way, I mean, calling out, we see this all the time in social media. It's seen as a way of demonstrating to people that they've done something wrong and that we want to hold the line here. What I liked about the contribution is that it starts by recognizing the attraction of doing that. But it says, as soon as you start getting into this, it's actually very difficult to do effectively. So are you really sure the rule is actually being breached, particularly when we're talking about norms around things like lockdown and social distancing, where there's a lot of ambiguity in the guidelines? Even if you're pretty sure that you know what the guideline itself is or the rule or the norm, you don't really know the circumstance of the particular case. And so we see this all the time around things like mask wearing and people having exemptions. And lastly, it's very, very hard to be proportionate and so to get your response kind of appropriate, because we've seen, I mean, so long prior to the pandemic, and I think this is part of what inspired Paul and Tom to go down the line of writing about this. John Ronson has this book called So You've Been Publicly Shamed, which talks about how these things can spiral out of control. People can lose their jobs, their kind of lives can be turned upside down. And you might not think that that's kind of proportionate to the individual kind of harm done by one person breaching the norm. I don't think they say there should be a blanket ban on it, but I think what they're saying is that it's very hard to do right, and it's very possible for that to go badly wrong.
You often got the sense, I think, during the pandemic that it was easier to post something angry on Twitter with a picture than to actually go up to someone and say, what are you doing outside? In fact, it was an easier thing to do. It's an easier route. Thinking about struggles we had about elections. Now, obviously, there were elections due in May 2020 in this country, and those were postponed. And the mayoral election, for example, a lot of local elections were postponed for a full year after the pandemic. And even then, because we were only just beginning to come out of the third lockdown in May 2021, there were lots of questions about whether we should be holding elections at all. Mm-hmm. And that's something else you tackle in the book, isn't it? Because it's a really tough one to know whether you're being fair to people to hold elections at that time.
Yeah, and that's, again, it's a contribution I like a lot because Alex quite nicely, he sets out a trilemma and he says that whatever you do, it's not going to be perfect. So you can try and go ahead with holding elections in person, but under the circumstances of COVID, some people it's going to be easier to get out to the ballot box than others. Some people are going to be more vulnerable or more afraid. And so inevitably that means not everyone has an equal opportunity or equal kind of it's not equally costly for everyone to go and vote. The second option is to do away with in-person voting and to make it all postal or online in some countries where they have the facility. But then I think there's less trust in that as a system and more worry that you don't get the privacy of the ballot box. You don't get to kind of you just being left alone with your conscience. And so there's a bit of a cost there as well. And the third option, the option that, as you said, we went with for local elections, as happened in Scotland in 2020, is you push it back by a year, or you push it back until the end of the crisis. But then you have kind of this problem of legitimacy of the government has kind of exceeded its term, gone on longer. And particularly in these sorts of crisis times when the decisions that are being taken are so big, if you have this kind of zombie government that has lost the legitimacy of its original election, but we can't have the opportunity to vote it out, that's not ideal either. And Alex, again, is quite measured and he says, depending on your context, or depending, for example, how good your postal vote infrastructure is, how much trust people have in that, depending on what the case rates are and how dangerous it is for people to vote, all of those things mean that in different contexts, the solution's going to be different. But he lays out the trade-offs, I think, quite nicely.
Let's talk a bit about the economics of it, because it was a massive challenge, obviously, to ensure people that when they were told to stay at home could had enough money to continue to live on. Of course, in this country, we went down the path of furlough, for the most part, with a few kind of extra add-ons elsewhere. That was a decision, wasn't it? It wasn't the decision that all countries took. The US took a very different path. Tell us a bit about how those decisions were made in different countries.
So, I mean, the first thing is they were made very quickly under kind of emergency circumstances. And I think basically the kind of the US versus Europe approach, probably the most helpful one, because in poorer countries, it's a very different thing where you've got less fiscal space, it's harder for the government to borrow. And that's an interesting conversation itself in terms of economic support that poorer countries got. But in terms of rich countries, the European approach, which kind of the UK belatedly cottoned onto, the kind of furlough maybe doesn't look that unusual by European standards, but it's very, very unusual by British standards, which is that you try and hold workers in their jobs and you replace their earnings. Whereas the US approach was to really bolster unemployment insurance and to kind of dole out cash, particularly kind of targeted at lower income people, on the understanding that people will leave their jobs, but they will have enough of a security net. And that also kind of had the byproduct, both furlough and the unemployment insurance, but particularly I think the US kind of stimulus approach had the benefit of it puts money in people's pockets so that their spending power is increased. And we've seen this kind of relative boom in the American economy, which really is not what you would have expected. But I think the kind of European approach looks very good in the first instance because there's less disruption, there's unemployment goes up by less. But the worry is that you end up with these kind of zombie firms that have been held up artificially. And that might take a while to kind of play out. So it might be that some of the difficulties unwinding that are going to continue over the next couple of years.
There's been a lot of talk during the pandemic about who should pay for the huge amount of money spent on furlough and all the other ways that we propped up the economy. And people like, for example, Rachel Cunliffe, who writes for the New Statesman at the moment, have argued that this is not something that should be borne by people who are currently young now, because they have borne the brunt of the social distancing regulation. They have often lost their jobs and have not been able to go on furlough. There was a big bias in terms of who could go on furlough and between part-time jobs and full-time jobs and how long you've been in work. And she argues that because older people were the ones to benefit from lockdown policies in that they were the ones most likely to die of COVID, that therefore there should be a change in the way we tax people to reflect that. What's your take on that and the things that are going on and whether that could ever work?
Yeah, I think it's an increasingly kind of salient political divide, and I think it's political as well as economic. So Rachel's point is absolutely kind of well taken there, which is it is understandable that young people might get angry given the kind of sacrifices that have been forced on them, and particularly exacerbated by the kind of fiscal policy decisions that have happened, the national insurance rise in recent years, the tuition fee kind of the introduction and increase of tuition fees, which operates as a tax on younger people. And on top of that, the pension triple lock. But that kind of is in as part of a dynamic with the what's going on politically, where the age divide is becoming more and more salient. And I guess I've kind of conflated it there with age and education are also highly correlated. So you could say this is a young university grad versus older non-grads and older people more generally. There's a lot of different characteristics that all come together. And David Yarrow's contribution to this is, I think, quite good on this, because it says you can start very narrow and say young people bore the brunt of COVID. They're also going to have to pay the debt. And so therefore, we need to rebalance policy on that basis. And he says, but the pandemic is one of a number of different, somewhat arbitrary circumstances which have benefited one group in society over the other. And he says, particularly, we see this as particularly acute because of what's happened in the property market, where in the last 20 years, there's been this huge kind of boom, which has benefited a generation of people who got onto the property market at the right time and has left behind a generation of people who weren't able to catch the train in time. And so he says that you kind of need to be looking at a fundamental level at that political economy, and thinking about it young and old just in the framework of what's happened in the pandemic is just far too narrow. And we need to be looking at the kind of arbitrary shocks that have hit the economy and trying to balance that out more fairly. So that means kind of addressing the windfalls in wealth that some have accrued. That means fixing these are easy things to say, but fixing the disorder of the housing market. A first start would be trying not to make it worse, which some of the intergenerational policies maybe have done.
Just in terms of what the current policies that the government is pursuing, do you think that they're sufficiently aware of that, or are we continuing down the wrong path in terms of intergenerational inequality?
I mean, the cynical thing would be, I'm worried that they are aware of it and that it's a deliberate policy. Maybe that's too cynical. But I don't know how stable it is, because it feels like, I mean, we saw kind of a step back on the pensions triple lock, and we'll see in the longer term how that works out. In that particular case, it's a very complicated policy, because obviously young people will grow up to be pensioners one day, and there is more political attention being drawn to that divide, and so it'll be harder to avoid. And I think there's only so far you can go with kind of stoking that or being seen to be too unfair on one side. So we'll see how much road there is to run on it.
Certainly, they seem to be going down the path of trying to level up, whatever that means, differences between regions, and it's about geography. That seems to be the tenor of this government, as far as I can tell, and trying to make places more prosperous rather than focusing on people. Long time to go yet to work out exactly what levelling up means. One of the most obvious difficult chapters in this book is looking at who you treat first during a pandemic, because during a pandemic, people die, and some of them are more likely to die than others. Some will not survive treatment. It's very hard to work out often which ones those will be. But there is a way of looking at it more systematically, which can really help us to do that. And it's something that people turn away from and didn't want to think about, understandably, during the pandemic, because it was just such a horrible thought to think that people might be being effectively left to die, or left to dry in perhaps, you know, the most comfortable circumstances possible, but still left to die. Tell us about some of the ways in which we can think about that, and how to try and essentially, it is partly about weighing up the value of a human life in a particular time, but you can do that very sensitively, can't you?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing to say is that this already happens every day to a large extent. It is just an inevitable way of, it's just an inevitable consequence of the fact that we have limited resources and limited capacity to help everyone who might need help, we have to make trade-offs in various domains. We have quite kind of established processes, for example, in terms of what treatments we'll fund in the healthcare service, or what drugs we'll buy, or how to prioritize treatment kind of under ordinary circumstances, who will get treated and who will just be kind of managed in a sense. But obviously, in an emergency circumstance, those pressures become more acute. We've heard a lot about the NHS kind of potentially being overwhelmed, and in other countries where healthcare systems, there's no doubt about it, where they have been overwhelmed. And so Sarah's chapter in the book looks at what are the different rules that are applied, or what are the different rules that philosophers have come up with, which I think have been quite inconsistently and imperfectly applied in everyday practice, in terms of what criteria do you use to say who should get prioritized for treatment? So should it be kind of on age and health and how likely they are to recover? Should it be on the severity of the illness? I mean, a lot of the kind of standard things. But her claim that she's arguing for is that at least some priority should go to helping those who in turn will be able to save the lives of others in an immediate, in a kind of crisis situation. So in the first instance, if it's a doctor who's sick, then if you can deal with them and get them back on their feet in a matter of weeks, then they can go back onto the front line and save X many lives on top of that. But I think she's open to the possibility that there might be other people who are making as important enough of a contribution. So if logistics is a big pinch point, we could be in a situation where prioritizing lorry drivers who are delivering food to people who need it or kind of essential supplies, they might jump the queue, so to speak, or be pushed up the queue. That's the argument, and I think that it's a kind of a useful contribution to the debate, A, to flesh out the implicit rules that are used, and also to argue for one position there.
During the pandemic, we've had to take hard decisions about when to close schools and how long to wait before opening them again. How have we done in making those decisions? Did we get them right? How have we treated children during the pandemic?
It's interesting because usually we think of children as the most vulnerable. And what's interesting about this pandemic, or what's made it quite different to normal emergency circumstances, is that isn't obviously true, because obviously children are less susceptible to COVID. And so that's kind of scrambled things from the start. I think there has been a bit of push and pull in terms of the educational kind of impact. And I think within the discourse, it's quite hard for me to step outside of the education policy discourse, but I think there's also been an awareness of kind of mental health. I think maybe plausibly like 10 or 15 years ago, in a different kind of culture and a different understanding of what we owe children and how we think about the relative importance of educational outcomes as opposed to kind of mental health and well-being, that would have been quite different. So I think a lot of the right noises have been made by a lot of the right people, as we're seeing with the debate over the COVID kind of catch-up funding. It's not clear that the resources have been put in behind that. I think certainly if we look at school closures were often sensible, and there was a lot of scrambling to kind of do the best that you can under difficult circumstances. I think that there were kind of administrative issues around exams. But I think the first thing I would start with is I think that a lot of intentions seem to have been broadly good, even if people haven't been able to kind of live up to their stated ideals. And I think there was some healthy things about how we value kind of different elements of childhood.
Just to wrap up, I was wondering if as an economist you could talk a bit about how you see the next year. I don't want to get too much into futurology because that's always difficult. Yeah. But in the next year, the challenges coming up for politics generally, for the way we think about politics and economics, what big things do you think we will be discussing in the next 6-12 months that you're worried about now?
So I'll start with the economics because that's a bit easier. That's a kind of more bounded question. I think economics has been kind of hit on its axis over the last 10 or 15 years with everything post-financial crisis, but it feels particularly uncertain just now because, I mean, COVID was unlike, I think, anything in the history of economics that we've seen, where you're deliberately shutting down parts of the economy and all the kind of normal rules are suspended. We just haven't seen economies behave like this before. And so I think we can make plausible guesses as to what's going on, and some guesses are more plausible than others, and we can also kind of evaluate risks. The big debate that we're seeing right now around how worried should we be about inflation, I think that we can use the heuristic that while inflation is bad, that the consequences of unemployment and of stagnant wage growth are probably worse. And so if you err on the side of one risk, I'd be erring on the side of probably trying to do everything you can to keep output and growth high. But I think it's just so uncertain still. I know we've been saying this for a year and a half, but it will continue to be because it's really unprecedented on an economic front. And I guess that's probably true more broadly of politics as well, because downstream of that, what I'm saying about the economy, I think it's true of society in lots of ways as well. This is perhaps not unprecedented, but the things that we reach back for are things like coming out of Spanish flu, which is so different, or Ebola. It's different kind of contexts and societies. There still is a sense that things are up for grabs. It's interesting kind of reflecting back on this book, because one of the difficulties that we had as we started writing this quite early on in essentially spring, summer of 2020, and we were thinking, is any of this going to be relevant? We don't know when exactly it's going to come out because the lag time is so long. And actually, it's kind of heartening that a lot of this stuff is still in many ways as relevant. The one thing that I think is less certain is it felt like at the time there was this moment of there's huge kind of possibility and there's huge discussion about could we radically reshape society in different ways, and an openness to fundamentally changing things, not least because we'd had the demonstration of we can do things so, so differently. We can order people to all stay at home and they will broadly do it, which, I mean, that's not a good thing to do, but it shows you kind of the immense social power that we have. And my worry is maybe a little bit of that is dissipating. There's areas where I think that kind of willingness to think big and think radical is sustained. I think we probably will see kind of big changes, but I think we should try and sustain that sense of power and opportunity as increasingly we have more chance to go out and do things.
Thanks so much for talking to us, Avik.
Thank you.
Political Philosophy in a Pandemic is published by Bloomsbury Academic. We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. If you did, you can help us to reach more people by forwarding the episode link to 3 friends or tweet it to them with the hashtag BunkerUp. Get them to send us their feedback. It's really useful. If you enjoy The Bunker, you can help us keep going by backing us on the crowdfunder Patreon. Search Patreon Bunker Podcast to find out how to get the show early and without ads, plus lots of extra benefits. I'm Ros Taylor. Thanks for listening.
The Bunker Daily was presented by Ros Taylor. The producer was Andrew Harrison. The assistant producers were Jacob Archbold and Yelena Sofronievich. And audio production was by me, Alex Rees. Theme tune by Kenny Dickinson. The Bunker is a Podmasters production.